And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I've got a bunch of questions to answer today. I always hope that one of these will somehow apply to each of you. But I want to start with a real-life story. A real-life story with an ending that is totally unknown. About an amount of money that's totally unimportant. And yet, it's a story I think we need to teach young people about the value of time and compounding. And here's the story. I wanted to help a son of my niece when he was going to college. He was working hard. He was going to the University of Washington. And I felt I could financially do a little something to help out. So I gave him $3,000 a year towards his education. It didn't change my life. And I thought, well, maybe, just maybe, it could change his. And he has graduated and done just fine. And then his younger brother comes along, but the story was different. The younger brother was going to college as well. The only difference being he found a way to do it at less cost at another school. And they're both hard workers. They were both working while they're going to school. But I did feel an obligation, even though the younger brother didn't need the help. If I've given to one, I should give to the other. So I came up with a plan. And it probably won't shock you to know that what I decided to do was, rather than help pay for the schooling, to take that same amount of money and put it into help him, in essence, put it into a Roth IRA at a very young age. And if you've read a recent article and heard the podcast about this idea of putting money away for 5 years into small cap value into a Roth IRA and then just letting it ride literally for the rest of one's life. I mean, you let it ride to retirement, and then in retirement you start taking money out, whether you're 65 or 70 or 75, whatever will be the flavor of the day when you get there. Then you take money out and then you leave what's left over to your heirs. And you may remember that table. If you put away $6,000 a year for the 5 years, and you started at age 21, as I remember, then you ended up, theoretically, if you left it in small cap value, and if you got a 12% compound rate of return, it would turn into somewhere between $30 and $50 million. It's pretty amazing, but it's nothing more than the mathematics of compounding over more years, certainly, than I have left. But it's not 6,000 in this case, it's 3,000. So you divide all those numbers by two. And I painted that picture for him. And he actually, as part of this process, did something I asked. I said, would you please first read, we're talking millions, 12 simple ways to supercharge your retirement. By the way, I'm sorry we called it supercharge your retirement. In hindsight, I wish we had called it supercharge your investment, because a lot of young people aren't even thinking about retirement. But he read it. And he said he really got it. He understood it. And I asked him a few questions. And yes, he did get it. But what he didn't get, and I'm so embarrassed that the book did not make this so crystal clear, he wanted to know, okay, now you are going to give me this $3,000. I'm earning money so I can legitimately put it into a Roth IRA. How do I open the account? So I went through the steps. You can go to a Vanguard or a Schwab or Fidelity. and you can open the account. And that's how they make a living, is helping people who have a little bit of money start to grow it to become a lot. So they're going to help you through that. But in the process, an interesting thing happened. He had the money. He talked to the people at Fidelity. And there were some reasons why Fidelity was probably a better fit. One of the things I really like is not only can you get commission-free trades on ETFs, but you also can buy in partial shares. As many of you may know, with ETFs, most places you go to buy them, you can only buy the number of shares and whatever that price per share is. So if you own 100 shares or 98 shares, you got to own it in whole shares. Now, that makes life a little complicated because then people have got to do a little math, whereas if you can buy partial shares, you can say, I want to buy $3,000 worth, and maybe you'll end up with 100.261 shares and get exactly what you ordered. Well, he talked to the folks at Fidelity, and he had the money, and he got it into the account. And then he was about to buy, and he called and he asked a question. And I made it very clear. I said, look, if you need something, these Fidelity folks are well-trained. Just call them, but do me a favor. Do not place the order with them. Because if you place the order with them, then there is a commission that is paid to do that. So get your information and then go back and make that purchase. And all future purchases online and get around that commission. So he had a question. I don't even remember what the question was. By the way, interestingly enough, the rep at Fidelity actually asked him where he got this idea to put this money into the Avanta Small Cap Value ETF. And he said, well, I got that from somebody I know. And then he gave them my name. And the guy actually took the time to go to our website and look at our work. I don't mean he read a bunch of articles, but he saw the home page. And he came back and he said to this young fellow that I'm trying to help, he said, yeah, looks like he knows what he's talking about. But before you place that order, do you want to put that money into the ETF, exchange-traded fund, or do you want to put it into the mutual fund, the regular open-end mutual fund? Now, there are some slight advantages to the mutual fund. There are more advantages, probably, to the ETF in most cases. Well, this was a dilemma because he wasn't sure. So he hangs up. He doesn't place the order like he wanted to that day and sends me an email. And by the time I get back to him about that, the order had to go in the next day. Well, the answer was the reason he wanted the ETF was because the ETF you could invest without a minimum. I mean, literally, you could buy $25 worth. But if you want to buy the mutual fund, AVUVX, that X indicates a mutual fund. If you wanted to buy that mutual fund, the minimum size purchase is $5 million. In other words, the rep at Fidelity didn't know the rest of the story. And probably didn't have the time to go figure out it had a $5 million minimum. And so we held up the purchase for one day, and I said, no, it's a $5 million, and you need to buy the ETF. Now, it's important to understand this $5 million minimum, that's not about being an exclusive club. It's because that particular fund is built for investment advisors and their clients. And in fact, I think in most cases, the ETF is going to be the better of the two investments. But what we did was we lost a day. And in that day, that mutual fund went up about 3%. So by the time he got into the investment, he missed about a $90 profit. Now, we don't want people thinking about a $90 profit. He's not trying to worry about the market one day at a time. But that difference of $90 actually is meaningful. And so I couldn't help but explain to him why that is meaningful. And the reason being is that when you make a lump sum investment, I don't care whether it's $90 or $1 million, when you make a lump sum investment and you don't add any money to that particular investment, or you don't take any money away, then it absolutely doesn't matter what the series of events, year-to-year returns will be, some years good, some years bad. Doesn't matter whether the bad years come early or come late. The end result is going to be the compound rate of return of that $90, if he could have had that $90. Now, it's important that we understand that at age 20, it's not unlikely you're going to live another 70 years. In fact, young people being born today supposedly have a 50-50 shot of living in the U.S. to 103. In Japan, it's 107. Now, that means that $90 could have been compounding in his account for 70 years. I just made that number up just so I could show him the impact of $90 compounding at 12%. That's the dream, and we think that's reasonable, remembering this is an asset class that for the last 94 years, if you looked at every 40-year period, the average compound rate of return was 16%. So 12 doesn't seem to be absolutely impossible. $90 compounding at 12% for 70 years grows to be worth about $250,000. And so while I don't want people to be thinking about what one day's difference would make, I just want you to understand there is an impact. And you understand why I don't want him to pay a commission, let's say, of $25, instead of taking that time, the time to do it online and having that $25 compounding for his life rather than in Fidelity's life. And it's why I want them to be in funds that have low expenses and have low turnover and be a kind of fund that you don't have to worry that something's wrong with the mind of the manager. He's gone nuts. No, it's basically an index fund. Not exactly an index fund, but basically what we call an asset class fund, AVUV. So I thought that was a pretty interesting lesson for him. And I think it's something that could impact his thinking. The fact that through one simple little mistake, and I'm not holding the Fidelity rep accountable, and there are a million things that he needs to know and look up, and that was one he didn't look up. So that's my story about how $90 missed could be worth $250,000. Maybe there's a story that you could come up with, you would share with me, that you think other people would enjoy, and that cost of missing that opportunity. By the way, this is not so dissimilar from the choice that somebody has to make. And I know it's a tough one, and that is you've just inherited $1 million or $100,000 or $2,000, and you got to invest it or not, but you want to have it be invested for the long term. It's the right thing to invest immediately, put it to work, don't worry. Or is it better to dollar cost average in? Well, more than likely, you're better off just putting it all in. But you're also at risk that what's going to happen for the first year you own it is going to go down. But the probabilities are, in the long term, the sooner you get it in, the more money you're likely to make. All right, well, let's get into some Q&As that have come in. There have been a lot of them. Here's one from Jordan. Jordan wants to know, can you recommend a fee-only advisor that can work virtually? This is an amazing question. This is a huge question. As a matter of fact, just by chance, I spoke this morning to an investor who is retired and is looking for a fee-only hourly advisor that he can work with that can give him advice, not on a percentage of assets under management. He did that for years. He was paying $40,000 a year to get investment advice. And one day, or maybe one week, or at some point in time, there was a light that went off. He claims it was because he had read our work, but I'm sure he had read similar things before. But at that moment in time, you know what they say about when the student is ready, the teacher will come. Well, that day, maybe I was the teacher, but he realized that $40,000 was a cost of living to him, and that if he could figure out how to eliminate that $40,000, it would mean it could either be spent on other things that were more immediately enjoyable, or he could just have that money set aside to continue to grow for his kids. But for both of these people, it isn't necessarily a slam dunk. Because even when people say that they will do work hourly, in many cases, yes, but there'll be a minimum number of hours I'm willing to put in there to make this worth my while. Or what I really want to do is manage your money. I don't really want to do it hourly. So I think there are lots of people, they'll say, that are out there that will do that. It's not as easy as you think. And I am dedicated, not only because Jordan has asked, but I am dedicated in the coming months. I don't have much time to do it in the month of July, but I will be able to do this in August. And that is to find the steps to get a good advisor and hopefully in your area, but if necessary, virtually, that will in fact take care of young people just getting started, or not even young people getting started. Maybe it's older people who are trying to solve very specific financial problems, and they don't want to have to commit their money to a manager, and they don't trust themselves that they're able just to read the books and come up with the answer. By the way, in a lot of cases, the answer requires the knowledge of a tax expert. And a lot of people, including myself, they know a lot about investing, but they really don't know much about taxes. Not like you should if you pretend you're giving tax advice. So it should be easy to get virtual help. And I have now got a series of steps that I'm going to go through. I'm going to be contacting state societies of CPAs and talking with them. I'm going to be talking to some friends of mine in the industry that I know do hourly work, but it isn't exactly what they want to do. But under what conditions will they do it? Well, tell me about the client that you will help so that I can tell these people who follow our work, if you are this kind of an investor, here is somebody who will help. Now, I know many of you have asked for the list of people that I recommended in the state of Washington. Now, I didn't recommend them to be your advisor. I'm not an expert on all of the work they do. I do know they do hourly work. And I will put a link to that list for people, particularly who are looking for a local advisor and they live here in the Pacific Northwest. But I'm going to warn you right now, there is a chance at the point that you contact them, they are full up. I know, for example, now this is not in the state of Washington, but Rick Ferry, I was talking to Rick recently, and he gives, I think, great advice in terms of investments. I don't think Rick is a tax expert. I don't think he's an estate planning expert, but he is a guy that knows investing inside and out. And I think right now he has about a 9-month wait if you want to do work with him on an hourly basis. It's about 9 months before he can meet with you. So this is the problem is that the big money in this industry is not the hourly provider. And the people that do it know it. But many of the people who will do hourly also know that if they're licensed to be an investment, let's say an investment advisor, not just a CPA, that there's opportunity to build a book of business where they are managing other people's money. And there's a huge need for it because there are lots of people who are emotionally unstable enough, myself included, that they don't want to be the one to pull the trigger. They know that their tendency is to second guess some feeling that they have about what the market's going to do that should lead to some change in what they're doing. Any of us who fight that battle are better off probably to let somebody else do it. But Jordan, stay tuned. Because I'm going to do my best to create a list of steps that people should take. Here's another question. Rice says, I absolutely know we will have a severe decline, but no idea when. What are your recommendations for now as we are going into a severe correction? Well, my recommendations are to develop a long-term investment strategy that is built with your worst-case loss scenario. It's built into the strategy, and that you ignore this attempt to want to, in essence, market time when to get in or when to get out. The reality is that we all know that there are bear markets, and I mean substantial bear markets. In fact, I once saw a number that said that we have one every 4 to 5 years, and the average loss is 30% of the value of the portfolio. That number may or may not include the reinvestment of dividends. Oftentimes, those dividends are not included in figuring out how long a bear market lasts or how severe the loss was. There are some people who say that if you got into the peak of the market in 1929, it took until 1954 to break even. Well, it turns out, number one, that depends on whether it was a lump sum investment and no more money was being put in. It matters as to whether you count the dividends that you received to be reinvested, that it didn't take that long. In fact, in many cases, it took less than a decade to break even. Or if it was a lump sum investment and you reinvested that money, I don't remember the exact number of years, but it was less than 20 years to break even. So those kinds of studies, got to make sure you understand what the assumptions are. But the bottom line is, the intuitive or the advice, if you want to call it that, from Peter Lynch and Warren Buffett is, if you're not willing to lose half of your money, you shouldn't be in the stock market. Now, they're talking about having all of your money in the stock market. And so people like myself who have, let's say, in the buy and hold part of my portfolio, half in bonds and half in stocks, that's not going to lose 50% if the market goes down because I've got half of the money in short to intermediate term government bonds. Now, there are some people who think that U.S. government bonds are actually worthless, and so they might differ with my assumption or my conclusion. But the bottom line is that you kind of have to make a decision as an investor. And there are these choices. Dollar cost average, regardless. That's a choice. Ignore where the market is. You're guaranteed to buy fewer shares when the market is high. You're guaranteed to buy more shares when the market is low. That's one answer. Another is to simply divide your portfolio half in stocks, half in bonds, 75% in stocks, 25% in bonds, and just figure that regardless of what you feel about the market, that you are protected sufficiently in the amount of the bonds and that you want to be sure and be there when the rocket takes off. Now, when I was an advisor, I ran into situations where people were just nervous as could be about the market and believed they just could not take that risk anymore. So let's say that person was in their mid-40s or they're 50 years old and they're many years away from retirement. So in some of those cases, what we would do, we would take that bulk of the money that they already have, ignoring the extra money they're going to be putting in the future, and capturing that value almost like they are, in fact, retired. And they could be 60, 40, or 50, 50, whatever that combination of stocks and bonds might be. But I wanted them to maintain the state of mind of the buy and holder, of the young investor, if you will, with the new money they're putting in. Because with the new money they're putting in, they have taken a big body of money and protected it for the rest of their life. I mean, that's the theory. But the new money goes in as if they're a first-time investor, forcing them, if the market does go down, to buy more. Because if they're 10, 15, 20 years from retirement, and they have this big body of money that is defensively managed, it would make sense, at least in my mind, to treat that new money as if you are a first-time investor taking advantage of a bear market, not being afraid. This next question is a tough one because I'd like to make a commitment that's over the top. But the reality is we're not quite there yet, but I want to address the topic here. Because the question is, will data be provided in the future using Vanguard funds in regards to the portfolios, the sound investing portfolios, including the ultimate buy and hold portfolios, which would include the worldwide four funds? You know, one of the interesting challenges is that Chris Pederson has done a brilliant job, I think, of creating this best in class recommendations. And the reality here is that Vanguard does not, in every case, provide those asset classes we'd like to have in your portfolio as either a mutual fund or an ETF. But we have all of those available through Vanguard if you want to use the best-in-class ETFs. The same is true at Fidelity. And as I said earlier, there are some advantages at Fidelity over Vanguard when it comes to buying and selling ETFs. Now, but the question does go on to make the point that when you're trying to find the right funds to be inside of a 401k, that there's a limitation as to how many asset classes that you can get to. Now, what makes it complex, and we're not ignoring this challenge, but we really haven't come up with exactly the right answer, because if you have the potential of investing inside of a Roth IRA, inside for you and for your spouse, and you each have 401ks, it is possible that between all four of those investments that you would be able to access all of the asset classes. But we know that's difficult to try to create a balanced portfolio and to do the rebalancing when you've got part of the money in a Roth and the other part is in a 401k. So I'm going to guess that at some point we are going to figure out a formula approach as to how to invest in the 401k. And some 401ks only have just a handful of asset classes, maybe a large cap U.S. equity, international large cap equity. If they have any value at all, it'll be in the U.S. and not in the international. I'm talking large cap value. It is not impossible to find small cap value U.S. in the in 401ks, but pretty much unheard of in the international markets in 401ks. Are they gonna give you access to a small cap value? In fact, it's interesting. You're more likely to find access to an emerging market fund than you are a small cap value fund in 401ks. So there's work for 401ks to do. There's work for us to do, and of course for the people that have to do it and spread the money amongst many different accounts, it's a bit of a hassle. One of the things we are trying to do is to build the portfolio smaller and smaller, particularly if we believe by putting the portfolios and making them smaller and smaller, that you can still get at the basic asset classes, whether it is with Chris Patterson's work that he's done with Two Funds for Life, where it's some combination of small cap value and a target date fund that you're going to get inside of your 401k, or if you're fortunate enough to have access to a small cap value and the S&P 500. You can see in the work that we've recently done with the nine different portfolios, sound investing portfolios, you can see that that combination of small cap value and large cap blend in the U.S. does in fact give you access to the small and the value that you'd like to have added to your portfolio that is so often missing. So it may be that most of what we're after is available in just those two funds. But there is no question that for us, it's still a work in progress. Oh, and I love this question. And the answer comes with a ton of bias. And I'm sure for a lot of people, theoretically, a conflict of interest. But I'm gonna take it because I really enjoy the question, and maybe the answer will make sense. He says, this may seem like a silly question, but listening to your podcast, Get Smart or Get Screwed, made me come away with a sense that few advisory firms are worth the money. So my question, do you recommend Merriman Wealth Management, I am beginning to meet with them, but have not yet committed. Any advice? Well, first of all, while, and I think I suggested this earlier on this podcast, there are people who are not likely to take care of all the work that needs to be done to create the product that you deserve and the return that you deserve, and that will allow you to stay on course and not bail. There are people that are really good at fine details, and whatever stress others have, they don't. And there are people who don't care about the day-to-day news about the market or the day-to-day volatility of the market. And so for those people, generally an advisor is a waste of money. Now, having said that, in many cases, when I was an advisor, I had accounts that the people could have taken care of it themselves, but they wanted somebody to take care of at least part of that portfolio so that when they passed, if they passed first, there'd be somebody there to help the surviving spouse. And by the way, that surviving spouse could be a male or a female. I mean, there are lots of cases where the main investor in the family was a female. But most cases with older people, they were the males. So there's that whole series of questions about why you need an advisor. You don't need an advisor to put together a fund that has X amount of large and small and value and growth, etc. You don't even need an advisor to tell you that you should be in index funds. You can get that free all over the internet. And you can get it from Warren Buffett, and you can get it from all the academic community, almost all of the academic community would say buy index funds. Now, there are disagreements about how much you should have in these different index funds, but at the end of the day, and we've talked about that, the article that is on the White Coat Investor site that is entitled 150 portfolios better than yours. And then there's another site. It's the 235 Einstein portfolios. And they're both legitimate. There are so many ways to slice and dice. And at the end of the day, of course, there's this huge decision, how much fixed income and how much equity. But you don't need to hire an advisor, even if you don't know what to do, and pay them for the rest of your life if you can do that all yourself. But there are a lot of people who want that done for them and are willing to pay that price. So, what would I say about Merriman Wealth Management if I were on their payroll and looking for clients for them to manage money? Well, because I was there and helped put it all together, I would say that they are going to give as good of advice as any investment manager is likely to do. Now, there's some work that is done at the super wealthy size account that the traditional investment advisors don't do, and that's fine. That was actually never the market that I went after. I didn't think we were there to take care of people who had $20, $50, $100 million. It's not that it wouldn't be nice to do that, and it's really probably the end result isn't that much different between the person who's got $100 million and the person who's got $100,000. If the basic advice is good, you don't need to be fancy to do well financially. But there are people who want to be fancy. And I don't look at Merriman Wealth Management as a firm that manages fancy. but very good, and the advisors are terrific. They are selected not just for their knowledge, but their heart. And I mean that. They really go out of their way to make sure that these are people who are dedicated to taking care of others. Now, what is really different? Because I think every firm would like to hire people who are dedicated to helping others. They are dedicated to the things that the academic community believe in. Almost everything the academic community believes in. The one area and something that I think they do very special, and they do it for me, for our account, and that is, for part of my account, I don't want pure buy and hold. It's not that I can't really afford the risk of buy and hold. I can afford the risk. In fact, I could afford, theoretically, the risk of an all-equity portfolio. And we're going to write about that in the coming weeks. Why not be all equities for your whole life? Well, there's a lot of evidence that suggests that would be the smart thing to do. But not comfortable. So what I have is basically, or my wife and I, we have a portfolio that is half traditional buy and hold and half market timing. Now, I know that is not something that the academic community would recommend. Number one, very few people in the academic community understand market timing. And it isn't even that it's difficult to understand, but it is difficult for some people to understand that the goal of market timing is not about making more money. It is about having a portion of the portfolio, equity portfolio, and by the way, this could be true of bonds as well, because in that portfolio that we have, that my wife and I have, part of it's equity, part of it's bonds. 70% equity, 30% bonds, market timed. Has nothing to do with the buy and hold portion of our portfolio. In the buy and hold portion of our portfolio, the equities could go down 90%, and I'd just be sitting there watching it happen. But in the market timing strategy, that's not likely to happen. So I don't know of any other firm that, for the right kind of client, can combine both the disciplines of buy and hold and market timing. By the way, they're separated. Those two accounts that you might have being managed by a Merriman, one will have nothing to do with the other because they are totally different investment strategies. And one is built for the catastrophic in one way, and that is with the timing exit strategy. And the other, the catastrophic event, is simply controlled by how much in equity and how much in fixed income. And by the way, one of the things a good advisor will do that it's very difficult for the do-it-yourselfer to do is to rebalance when one set of equities, one set of asset classes have been way underperforming the other, and you're taking money out of the bond portion and putting it into the equity portion when the equity portion has fallen substantially. That is a very difficult thing to do. And at the end of the day, the quality of an investment advisor will likely be based on how efficient, proficient, effective they are in helping people stay the course. But by the way, that means they've done a good job of determining what that real risk tolerance is. Now, I've seen people who give a test about how much money or how much you should have in equity and how much you should have in fixed income. And the test asked you about how you would feel if your stocks went down 20%, and that's how they address the risk of the stock market. Are you kidding me? 20%? No, the question is how you feel when the equity market goes down 50% or more. And setting those original guidelines to make sure that the portfolio is likely to still be desired by the investor when the market is down and dirty. So there are reasons that advisors are necessary, but I also understand anybody. I mean, it's my wife is a little bit this way about insurance. She thinks I'm way too conservative when it comes to insurance, that I over-insure. But remember, I'm the guy that believes in market timing too. So you might understand that I might be the one that would be insuring more things than I may need to. And I'm paying a price for that. But that's because, you know, that's my comfort level. That's how I deal with the catastrophic. And the reality is, I have always worried about the catastrophic from the time I was a little kid until now. And other people, they cliff climb. I mean, you know, they skydive. They bungee jump. I have not done any of those things yet. And don't expect to, by the way. Anyway, I think Merriman can do things other advisors just don't do. But they are not going to try to talk somebody who believes in buy and hold into being a market timer. That is not their goal at all. I love this next question. The person says, I am modifying my portfolio now and wondering why to include small cap blend. You have pointed out that small cap growth is generally a poor investment. So with regards to the small caps, why not just stick with value? Well, that's a great question, because what we know is the S&P 500 is made up mostly of growth, but it has some value. But because it's a cap-weighted index, the S&P 500, and because it's partly growth and partly value, it is going to be the big growth companies that are going to drive most of the return. And so the value is not going to be highly impactful in that portfolio. And what's the outcome of that? When you take the growth out of the portfolio and are left with just the value itself over a long period of time, it makes a better rate of return. I mean, we have a table that we work out of, goes back to 1928. And the advantage to large cap value is about 1% a year. And when you look at all the 40-year periods, the spread between the S&P 500 and large cap value is even wider. And there's a reason for that, and it's an important reason for that, and it's likely the reason that you want to keep some blend in your portfolio, whether it's large cap blend or small cap blend. Because in the Depression, value, doesn't matter whether it was small or large, collapsed. And so the question is, do you want to take that risk? As you know, we have in our nine portfolios, by the way, there's really eight portfolios, plus we show the S&P 500 by itself as kind of the benchmark. But you notice in those eight, there is one that is half U.S. small value and half U.S. large value. And the only thing that did any better than that combination was the small cap value itself on its own. So sometimes, and this is the problem, like a few minutes ago I was talking about market timing and being concerned about the catastrophic. In our buy and hold portfolio that my wife and I, that we have for our retirement, it is 50-50 stocks and bonds. And in the stocks, it is 50-50 U.S. international. And it is 50-50 between large and small. And the large and the small are divided 50-50 between blend and value. So overall, the portfolio is probably close to 75%, or let's call it 65 to 75% in forms of value. And because there are periods that growth is so much better and becomes disheartening to the person who has none in their portfolio, there was a DFA advisor, and boy, did they learn their lesson. They had their clients in the 90s, virtually all in value. You could do that at DFA. They didn't tell you what you had to put it in. They said, look, here are the index funds that we have. Let us show you how to use them. But at the end of the day, you did not have to follow their recommendations for how much in large and small and value and growth. And these advisors saw the history of value over growth and decided, we're going to do the best for our clients. We're going to put them all in value. And for a long period of time, value didn't do well. Now, you can imagine what happened to their business. It fell apart. It fell apart to the extent that they were either going to have to change and become more traditional because people couldn't take it. They couldn't take it even with having a professional taking care of it. As a matter of fact, the conclusion was the professional didn't know what the heck he was doing. If what we advise here to you doesn't work out like you thought it was going to, you could legitimately say, well, we're sorry that Paul passed, but God, he was a lousy advisor. Turned out he didn't know anything because growth did better than value before he died or after he died. Whatever, doesn't matter. I can be wrong forever. Anybody can be wrong forever. But if you stay diversified, you're not going to be wrong on everything, and not being wrong on everything includes having some growth in the portfolio. By the way, I think it's important, who probably have some problems, some challenge with believing that good growth companies shouldn't be better than value companies. But here is what happens. Growth companies are so wonderful that people pay and pay and pay up in what they're willing to guess about the future. Remember, a high price earnings ratio is a belief that in the future they're going to be making a lot more money than they're making now. And at some point, companies get so big, they can't do that anymore. But if you look at the growth index has a PE ratio that's about twice that of the value index. And so what happens when those great growth companies stumble? Well, for those who were around in 2000 through 2002, you could have a tech company that came out and they missed their, in fact, they might not even, they wouldn't miss their mark, but by a few pennies on their earnings and 25% taken off the value of the company within seconds. I mean, literally, within minutes after the end of the market and the after-hours trading, if that report didn't come out as these overly optimistic investors felt it should, that price could go down 25% in just seconds. It almost is like magic that they know where to take it. I don't understand how that works, but that's what happens. Whereas the value company, the one that is out of favor, the one that is struggling for whatever reason, has already been through some of that terrible time to get to where they are. And now, if bad information comes out about one of those companies, other than it's going bankrupt, that it isn't going to likely be, oh my God, I don't believe this has happened. No, it's kind of more of the same. In fact, the experts say something like this, that if you bought a portfolio of value companies, out-of-favor companies, 5 years from now, half of them will still be dogs. And it's the other half that nobody knows how to identify up front. Because if you knew how to identify those that are going to rise back out of the ashes so beautifully, you could make more on those by far than you would the great growth companies. But it's that half that make it that pull the long-term returns up above the growth that gets so badly hammered when some unexpected news arises. And I love this question too. I mean, while I have no idea what the answer is to the question, I will once more share my feelings about cryptocurrency. Because the question is, what will it take for you to change your mind on cryptocurrency? And by the way, I think it is interesting to note that in surveys, particularly that were taken before the recent huge decline in the value of cryptocurrencies, a majority of advisors and salespeople inside the financial community are okay with putting 3 to 10% of your money into cryptocurrencies. You know, it is always more work and on a short-term basis, less profitable to educate an investor than it is to simply nod your head, yes, it's okay with a small amount of your portfolio. There are people who will tell you it's okay to do almost anything with a small percentage of your portfolio. They would even say, in essence, it's okay if you want to go to Vegas with that amount of money you're willing to lose. And I just don't, not part of that thought process group. I say this, I don't care what you do with money that is not necessary for the goals that you have and the needs that you're likely to have when you're older. And if you know you're not going to need that money, you got plenty, and you don't want to leave it to kids, and you don't want to leave it to charities, then you can do anything you want with it. In fact, if it's money to burn, you could also give it to charities now. That's great. You don't have to wait till we die to give money away to charities, obviously. So, in a way, it kind of fits into the same basket to me as, and not buying lottery tickets, because you could put $10 into lottery tickets and we know the probability is the return will be absolutely nothing. With cryptocurrencies, if you put $10 into them today, I think they'll still probably be trading worth something tomorrow. Because there are people who are willing to do it. I mean, we all know that lottery tickets are likely to be a total loss. Total loss. If we keep putting, you know, put $100 a week in, and if you happen to get a ticket that pays you $10, that's okay. Just put it right back in. Keep it going until you win the $250 million. You don't say, I quit until you... Most people, I don't mean most people, all but some small fraction are ever going to make anything on lottery tickets if they just keep putting it back in. But that doesn't keep people from buying lottery tickets. The people I really get upset for are the people who have been told that buying cryptocurrency is your way out of the low-income life you're in. to take you to the next ring of importance. I don't know anything about those people that are saying that to low-income people, but I sense that money has something to do with it. And not money for the low-income people, but money for the people who are telling them, if you want to do better, you should do this. And oh, by the way, thanks for taking me out of the low-income arena by buying my cryptocurrency ideas. But I can't change this belief system that it's an unregulated security that is being treated like one that is regulated. In fact, the reason a lot of people like it is because it's not regulated. And that's a club to belong to anyway. I mean, it's like people who trade millions and millions of dollars in fine art. I think that's a special group of people. I don't care if they're doing it with cryptocurrency or they're doing it with a painting that they think is going to increase in value. That's just a market unto itself. Religions can be like that, can't they? They're just for a special group of people. Well, I don't see cryptocurrency as something that is built to grow. It's not like a company that's producing products and selling them with the idea of having a profit. That is, in fact, a legitimate investment. But I do not see cryptocurrency just as I don't see commodities as a diversifier or an adequate inflation hedge. You'd know that the story about cryptocurrency was that they were supposed to be a hedge against inflation. Well, their first opportunity so far hasn't looked like that's going to be. Now, it doesn't mean it won't be in the future. And the fact that it's unregulated, to me, suggests that it is a great place for the black market transactions. Again, this is a special club too, a very special club. There are these people, let's call them evil for the sake of discussion here. I'm not talking about everybody who does this is evil, but I'm saying there are some evil people who what they are doing is they're transacting whatever thing they're doing with cryptocurrency. Now they got to figure out a way to turn it into dollars because it's the dollars they need to put away that's going to let them buy the things they want to buy. And where are they going to get rid of these Bitcoin? Well, why don't we convince young people to start buying them from us? Give us their dollars, please. And we'll get out of this dark money we've got here and turn it into stuff that's really good. And then you young people can pretend like you're onto something really hot. And of course, there is this big question about the use of energy that's needed to power the building of the Bitcoin blockchain. And by the way, when I say that, I'm not pretending that I understand it all. But if we're trying to preserve energy, I'm not sure that we're doing that. Now, it is fair to say that there is an industry that has been developed, and they're making money off of it. Yeah. I mean, that's the way it works. Las Vegas is absolutely legitimate. Making alcohol is legitimate. Well, sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't in terms of the government. But the bottom line is that from everything that I know, remembering what Warren Buffett and Benjamin Graham said, price is what you pay, value is what you get, and I don't get the value in cryptocurrency other than to be part of that club. And I understand being part of a club, and I know that that's what makes people feel good, is to be part of a club. I just don't want to be encouraging particularly young people or any people to put something money into something that is not likely to give you the reward that you expected. But certainly, I can be wrong. And finally today, I want to address a question. It comes in a lot of different forms. In a way, it almost sounds like the cryptocurrency question about basically should that be in the portfolio. But this kind of question has to do with how different asset classes end up in the portfolios that we recommend. And remember, the asset classes that are identified here that we recommend, that didn't come out of my mind. I am simply sharing with you the work that has been done by the academic community to identify the asset classes that have a historical premium. But they don't generally look at sectors. Now, when I say that they don't look at sectors, when they build the large cap value portfolio and they are selecting companies that have high book markets compared to their market value, if that's the way they find them, screen them, then that could be from any industry. And you will find that at different times in history, that value portfolio is heavily based on maybe financials when they get in trouble, on energy when they get in trouble. It could even be on technology when they get in trouble, because it's points at which companies and sectors and industries have been in trouble and become the kind of growth wannabes. They want people to think they're growth companies, but they're not being priced like growth companies. Now, even Microsoft got down to a low PE ratio. Remember, it went from, over $60 a share. I think that was the high in 2000, down to someplace close to $10 a share. And so the question in this particular case is, why include REITs but not include energy in the recommended portfolio? And this, if you go back to the that ultimate buy and hold presentation I make, where it shows you start with portfolio one is all the S&P 500. And then you add a little bit of large cap value, and the return goes up a little bit. And then you own it, you add another 10% in small cap blend, the return goes up a little bit. And every time you add these different equity asset classes, it has either an impact on the volatility, or let's call it the risk, or it has some impact on the return. But in every case, as you add the large cap value, then the small cap blend, then the small cap value, then the REITs, and then you go to the international markets doing the large blend, small blend, large value, small value, and then emerging markets. So you have these 10 different equity asset classes. Buried inside of there is a lot of energy. Buried inside of there, as part of that diversification, is a lot of healthcare, for example. I mean, healthcare is the one people often ask about it, because healthcare has had this great run. So what is there about REITs that makes them special enough to be on the list? Now, remember what the benchmark is. The benchmark has been the S&P 500. So when you compare long-term returns, it's very common to be comparing it to the S&P 500. And in fact, REITs are very different in times of good times and bad from the S&P 500. Not always, but at a lot of times, just like you would find the same thing between growth and value. and REITs are a different kind of asset class. I mean, it is some sort of ownership or participation in the real estate market, which is different from manufacturing products that are built to be sold and to depreciate, oftentimes, at least in our family, very quickly. So it is the academics have viewed it as a separate asset class, yet, yes, it is kind of an industry, but if you look at all the different ways that REITs are built, it is massively diversified itself in terms of the kinds of securities that you can invest in through REITs. So I don't know if that's the perfect answer, but I can tell you that the academics believe you got plenty of energy in the portfolios as they are built today. So I hope some of these questions are helpful. The answers are helpful. Keep them coming. We are, as you know, dedicated to finding new ways to help each of you be a better investors. And you know, the favor you can do for me is tell your friends about our website, tell your friends about our free book, We're Talking Millions, and tell them about our commitment to helping them be a better, more secure investor. So thanks for all your help. Thank you, by the way, for the contributions that many of you have helped us with, because it's being put to work, and you'll see some of that work in the coming weeks. All right, all the best.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.